the grade cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer Podcast. Well, where else can you combine the heroics, the legendary matches, the stories, the fame, the grace of Doug Bollinger with, well, Steve Waugh? Two icons of Australian cricket join the show to discuss Ashes, salads, giving 150,000%, and yes, we'll ask Steve about watching his son play against North Sydney on that fateful afternoon. We'll catch up with how we're supposed to feel post-Headingley and look forward to Old Trafford, where Khawaja is out, so is Jimmy Anderson, Stark is back, and Mitch Marsh is still Mitch Marsh. Hashtag AskTGC involves seeing Johnny Bairstow at Twickenham, knocking in a bat in an apartment block, wearing smugglers in the showers, and what cricket has done to one 17-year-old in the final year of school. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined by Dave Edwards in Sydney and Sam Perry in Melbourne. And boys, how does everyone feel after the third test there?
Evening Higgos, evening Dave. I feel buoyed. We talk about the seven stages of grieving a lot in cricket, don't we?
Always.
I think I'm at the end stage. It's always hard to know as an Australian whether that's just, whether that's woke revisionism or just denial, on our part. And it'll be interesting to see that from Australia as well. A lot of the Australian, what's coming out of the Australian camp is, look, we feel good, Everything's looking really good, feeling really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do think they've acknowledged what happened. Because that was a real phenomenon. That was a real moment. Mm-hmm. And everything always comes back to the grade cricketer, he said arrogantly. Mm-hmm. I did note that as the, little bits of details are emerging now of what happened in the immediate aftermath of that, phenomenal fixture. And details will be emerging for the next kind of 20 years, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But in the immediate aftermath, it's, that Tim Payne went to the dressing room and composed himself. And just before he delivered one of the great addresses, he needed a setting to get himself right. And of course, where do you go for that? The tubs. He went to the showers. And there's been I've never seen more column inches in international cricket devoted to shower talk.
Column inches.
Than there has been this week, talking inches. Than there was with Tim Payne's solo tub after the match. And it could be the solo tub. And I'd be interested to know about his status for that tub, whether that tub actually turns the series back in Australia's favour. Because apparently he delivered an amazing address. He just said, boys, it's 1-1. Didn't Stokes play well? He had a day out. And apparently they're good to go.
I think Churchill did some of his best work in the showers as well. Edo, sorry to you. I mean, how do you feel? You've taken a week to soak in what happened at Headingley. Are you mentally scarred, prepared for Old Trafford? How do you feel?
I learned that Justin Langer was physically sick after Headingley. I mean, we all were. I certainly was, and I dealt with that sickness by avoiding social media for an entire week, and I feel much better for it. Now, Old Trafford to me is exciting. It means Warnie's gatting ball first and foremost. And, I've already read an article on that just to whet my appetite for endless montages over the next week or so. Just really looking forward to, Richie Benaud's understated commentary and gatting's bemused expression, Warnie's peroxided hair. We were good then. Old Trafford has good, positive memories for us. And, Gatting will talk about how he thought the ball bounced off Healy's pads. Heels will talk about how he moved to the leg side before being shocked at the amount of drift and violent turn that it got. And Warnie will say, for the 10th time in a row on Twitter, wow, I can't believe it's been 27 years since that's happened. It's a favourite bedtime story for us and it makes us feel safe and comfortable. And that's what we need to feel now that, with what has happened a week ago, we've all just forgotten about it. Let's just treat it as an outlier. Let's just remember our previous dominance over England. Let's just push forward, always moving forward.
So
by looking back, can I just interject on the worn ball as well? Just a number of people I've heard in, the cricketing elite, among the cricketing elite, I'll leave it at that, who have both privately and openly questioned Richie Benaud's commentary of that ball.
Oh, come on.
To those people, A, don't worry. Your commentary stints will come when you're older. And B, just get that idea in the bin. It was understated and beautiful. Cheers. Okay, sorry, you guys.
No, I'm more of a Mark Taylor, Peter Sewell got a hat-trick on his birthday kind of man myself. But
Jamie Brayshaw would have treated that with the respect it deserved.
The big oil rig.
I call him Jamie, which I think he's not been called since about 96.
Alfred. So one thing that's happened in the immediate days after the match, lads, was this sort of revisionism of the Stokes LBW. Now, I don't understand. Now, a friend of the show, Ali Martin, has said on Twitter, you know, we're gaslighting you, and that may well be the case. But what I don't understand is, like, first of all, can we all accept, can the eyes have it in the room, it was fucking plum. It was missing nothing except maybe leg and off stump. It was absolutely plum. Mm. And the revisionism of it, if I can speak, would be that, like, I don't understand, like, why wouldn't you celebrate that, like, England have won a World Cup and a huge, significant test match in this series by massive umpiring mistakes? Why wouldn't you celebrate that? I don't understand it. Like, if that was Australia, this is the Stephen Bradbury moment, you know, the rest of the competition falling over at the final hurdle. And, like, you know, between Dharma Seema and Joel Wilson, they've both got it wrong massively. And, like, why aren't they celebrating it, lads?
Hmm. Well, look, it's... Well, I mean, the short answer, if you're from England, and rightly so, is what Ali says. It is gaslighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, who knows what these English people are saying in their private conversations. They probably are saying, that was fucking salmon. I don't know why I've got the word salmon in my head so much. Salmon trout.
Three reds.
I've never used that in my life. But for some reason, every time I see Nathan Lyon's ball, I just go, oh, it's fucking salmon. Like, I'm reduced to just being this, like, mono or bisyllabic person.
Yeah. Who, like, embrace it.
No other words.
It's a simpler way to live.
Because I'm so lost for words at how, you know.
But it was just one of those fucking LBWs where you just see, it's like when you're in the nets and you're watching someone and you just shout out, like, involuntarily, fuck off, like, you're out. Yeah. It's one of those ones. I don't care what technology says. We place a lot of faith in technology these days. I mean, the science is in on certain things, including climate change. But with regards to DRS, I don't take too much stock in DRS. I saw what I saw, and that was fucking out.
It's starting to get a little bit pernicious. Yeah. Like all phenomena in society, it's starting to kind of devolve into identity politics. Mm. And I've started to hear the word kind of, very Australian or un-Australian coming into play, you know, when it comes to expressing one's views in relation to this LBW. And I do wonder whether some people might enjoy being considered a bit un-Australian, you know, to underscore maybe their sophistication and friendship with the English people. Mm-hmm. All I can say is, you know, and I'm sorry to swear to current and future employers, but fucking salmon. And that is confirmed by the technology. It's confirmed by the eyes at the time. It's confirmed by the eyes in retrospect.
It's confirmed by the eyes at the time.
And I'm sorry that the ball wasn't going under the stumps. How incontrovertible do you need it to be? And let me finish by saying, therefore, that is funny. That is funny for English people. I hope that if you are English, you are laughing at this. But the contention that it was anything but out is extremely bemusing, and has its own identity issues sitting underneath it.
And when you say the eyes said it was out, I presume you're talking about the Handmaid's Tale kind of stuff, sort of a Big Brother organisation confirming and ruling everything. One thing that I've been thinking about during the week is, like, as you guys know, and I debrief with you regularly about, I can remember every single drop catch I've ever had, right? And, you know, first of all, Marcus Harris and probably maybe Dave Warner probably got away with it a bit because Nathan Lyon has had a moment that he will literally never be able to forget. And, like, I've painfully watched that many times. There's, like, the whole team are running down the middle of the pitch when the ball's thrown to Lyon. Like, Payne is, like, halfway down the wicket, and then he has to, like, stop celebrating, turn around to go back to the stumps as Lyon drops the ball. And I kind of, like, had this thought of, like, Payne in the showers after the game, like, reenacting the Goodwill Hunting scene where he just says, like, it's not your fault. And Lyon goes, I know. And then Payne says, no, it's not your fault. He says it over and over again until Lyon is embraced in the showers. But, like... he will never be able to forget that moment. And I'm like, that must be so painful. You know, and it's like, part of it's funny because it's just a game, isn't it? But at the same time, when you live your life within the parameters of professional sport, that has got to be just ultra demoralizing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, bat and ball sports we're talking about here. Yeah, well, I guess we'll find. I mean, I wonder if it will emerge, you know, in the days, months, years that it actually skipped off the deck a little bit. Oh, yeah, I'm a bit concerned.
Throws up, Pat. Was a bit, throws up.
It was actually a straight off break, you know, if you look at it. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, yeah, it's funny who kind of, which stories will be forgotten, given how kind of like, how huge Lions fumble was. Like on The Final Word the other day, great podcast with Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon, they interviewed Pat Cummins, and he made the point that he was a bit disappointed that like Stokes's final shot for four, where all the footage will be secured and played endlessly, was you know, that he delivered that ball. So it's like he's just forever going to be immortalised. But I don't think people are going to remember who bowled that final ball to Stokes. They're going to remember Lyon.
All right, well, let's move forward into the future. And the fourth test match at Old Trafford is happening. It's actually going to be tomorrow. That's crept up on me. I didn't realise that till today. I thought it might be a Thursday start, but it's a Wednesday start, 8 o'clock for Australian viewers on the Eastern Seaboard. Now I'm just reading out the timetable for television. I find it really interesting because everyone's sort of saying, like, that is an endearing moment in this series, and now England are going to cruise, or they'll sort of use that momentum swing and win the series, you know, 3-1 or whatever. And, like, I kind of look at the series as a whole, and at no point in the whole series have England looked like beating Australia. I mean, going to the final day of Lords, it was either going to be Australia or Australia win or a draw in that series. Ben Stokes is an absolute world. He scores a fantastic 100, you know, third test match, exactly the same thing. We're sort of forgetting that Australia absolutely smashed England in the first test match by a 1,062 runs and 2 wickets. And so it's sort of surprising that, like, whilst the perception is that Smith is holding the Australian team together, well, Ben Stokes is doing more so than what even Smith was doing in the three tests beforehand. So it's interesting moving forward. I mean, how do you guys foresee the fourth test planning out?
I can see the argument that England take momentum, and I know that there's been a kind of counter message put out there by Australia, particularly by Tim Payne, saying they don't get to pack momentum in their kit bags, using a nice little metaphor there,
nice.
You know, kind of personify. But I think if you step back, I can already hear the sound of the Old Trafford crowd, you know, as that match starts, and their anticipation that they're watching, you know, a great England fight back. And I think if you consider that, like, how much England are on the rise in this series, as in so many of their players that might have been a bit fatigued after the World Cup, might have been struggling, have just now come into the series. And then when you add Jofra Archer in, so you've got Archer, who's obviously, you know, pretty tough prospect for the Aussie batsman. If you factor in that Bairstow's come into the series a little bit, he played a pretty decent hand in that second innings. If you factor in that Joe Root's now come into the series with a pretty long innings, Joe Denley's now got a long knock under his belt and some confidence, and obviously Ben Stokes is, as we've said before, walking on air. You know, a lot of those, England seem to be getting better, you know, and growing into the series. And I think the question can be rightly asked, you know, did Australia miss their chance just there? On the Australian front, how many of their players are kind of growing into the series? It's a little bit harder to answer that question. Obviously, they've made some changes, and we'll get to that. And Steve Smith comes back in. Marnus Labuschagne's come in. But really, there's a few players who seem to have kind of found their level. And it's, you know, you're sort of hoping that someone can come out. You know, maybe Warner needs to do something. You know, but like I'm not sure where those extra runs come from for Australia. So,
All right.
Answer the argument.
Well, Dave, I'll throw to you. Khawaja is out. Khawaja's been dropped. Harris retains his spot at top of the order. So probably Labuschagne at 3. Smith comes in at 4. How do you feel about Usman being dropped for the fourth test?
Yeah, I don't know much about stats, but I do know that Khawaja has the best average of any test opening batsman in the history of cricket, which surprised me today when I read that. But that's, I mean, I know it's a small sample size, but that is interesting data.
Yes.
And he's not technically a specialist, though, is he? So we need to pick someone who's an inferior batsman who typically opens. Even, you know, when Khawaja does open, despite not doing it much, there's significant data to suggest that he's actually very effective at it. But we've gone with Harris. Fine. Okay. The interesting thing for me about Khawaja was that he was captain in the tour game. So what to me, what the selectors are saying here is that means nothing. Like, tour games are essentially meaningless if you're going to make a bloke captain in one, then just drop him the next game. So just the deception of making him captain.
Maybe they're letting him down lightly, like they're trying to give him a bit of a gift, you know, yeah. like you do with your child or something before you send him off to boarding school or something.
Yeah.
You know, take him out to lunch.
I thought that exactly, except I was going to use a corporate analogy about giving someone a bonus and then making moves behind the scenes to terminate them on grounds of incompetence. But the same thing applies with both analogies.
So a friend of the show of ESPN Crick Info, Dan Brittick, suggests that Kawaja would be right in the candidacy to replace Tim Payne for captaincy whenever that moment does come. Which is an interesting thought because it's pretty sparse. It's pretty sparse between who's going to captain between Payne retiring and Steve Smith inevitably getting the job again. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, I was kind of wasn't calling for it necessarily, but I could see it happening. I mean, Kawaja, Pez, I think you had the start. Was it 4 tours now 150? I think like the sample size there is far bigger than Kawaja opening the batting, for instance. And I think he's a fantastic batsman. He's one of the best batsmen in Australia, particularly in Australia. He had a fantastic series in Asia as well, but in England, it just doesn't seem to be working out for him. And I actually think whilst Harris is an inferior batsman overall, I think he is actually more likely to score runs at the top of the order, in my opinion. Now, one of the interesting things that happened during the week was Mitch Marsh was sort of hinted that he would be brought in back into the squad, and how laughable that seemed says a lot about Mitch Marsh's position within the cricketing public, given that he is actually in the squad and he is, you know, one of the best 14 cricketers in Australia, 15 cricketers in Australia. But the suggestion that he would be brought into the team was like, well, that's a fucking joke, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's like almost like a Trojan horse, wasn't it? Like they used Mitch Marsh to distract us. It was a distraction tool,
yep.
Much as it's been popularised in the Trump administration. I actually like the concept of Mitch Marsh much more than the actual product itself, and I like what he stands for. He's representative of this future where we can resolve all our problems through just this single off-the-shelf product that does it all. Like he's like a two-in-one shampoo and conditioner. Like he performs the duty of both the shampoo and the conditioner products, but in reality, you'd be better served actually getting a dedicated shampoo and a conditioner from a trusted salon brand. And,
sure.
You know, yeah, like where in the world is it hard, because I have no hair, but where in the world is it hard to keep your hair clean, presumably in kind of like dusty climes or...
Humidity, you know, people struggle with humidity.
High humidity or whatever.
Time for society though these days, like we don't have time for that. Spending 3 minutes to let the shampoo soak in and then rinse it and apply the conditioner. We need a three-in-one product, a shampoo, a conditioner and a body wash.
Mm. But let's say if you are going to the Daintree rainforest, you know, where there's high humidity, right, and you're trying to look after your hair, like you need a specialist shampoo,
yeah,
don't you?
Do.
Like this is, Daintree forest is fucking test cricket in England, you know, and like the idea that you get a two-in-one for the Daintree rainforest if you've got hair, which I don't, and you're trying to use that to clean your hair, well, you're only going to get a substandard result. And I think that's how we all felt at the suggestion that Mitch Marsh would come in, because that's, you know, the best indication of future performance is past performance, right? You know, was it an old Trevor Holmes dummy? You know, there's been a lot of talk about rugby league this week, given the touch footy game, the highly publicised touch footy game that the team played.
Oh, yeah.
Did Trevor Holmes sell his own dummy? And if so, why? Like, we were talking about distraction theory. Did we need to be distracted and talk about Mitch Marsh for 2 days? Nobody needed that.
Colm Inchers, though. I mean, we talked about Colm Inchers earlier.
What were they protecting us from talking about? Is something else happening in the Australian side? What are they distracting us from? I was very happy to talk about Steve Smith's face ball to Manus Labuschagne, whether there was separation and whether he got that ball down.
Mm.
And a lot of people, it should be added, have been saying, it came out in the Australian today, that Travis Head didn't know what he was doing. Well, he ran a wonderful outline for that ball. He did get cut, but he brought Marcus Harris in, just created the space for Labuschagne to score. So a bit harsh on Travis Head as well. I'll be expecting big things from him at Old Trafford.
I think what's happening here is that Trevor Holmes is distracting us from what's going on in Indonesia. You know, Jakarta's sinking, they're going to move the capital to Borneo. Okay. This is all part Hong of, Kong you know, protests. The government going on there. I mean, this is all part of it. I kind of think as well that, like, Australia spent 14 years trying to find, you know, Flint off 05, and now one test immediately after Stokes 19, we're just looking for Stokes. So looking for Stokes 19 now, so we can look forward to that.
But that's what we can't just do that. We're not going to find him. But no one's saying it. But everyone's like, we're not going to find him. It's like, no one's saying that we're going to find him. Mm. All that happened was that Holmes said, like, they asked Holmes, you know, what do you think of Mitch Marsh? Does he come into calculations? He top scored. And he's like, yeah, he's batted well. And, a reason for picking
him. No indication. Gave no indication that he'd be actually
selected. He's just not left-handed. He just made a simple point that he's not left-handed.
But Ben Stokes is like, Ben Stokes is a 3-in-1 product that actually works. So unless we literally steal England's IP, and Ben Stokes is their intellectual property, of course, we cannot simply replicate him using inferior materials, which is what Mitch Marsh is. He's not made of the same raw materials that Ben Stokes has been created from, so it would be foolhardy to attempt such a selection.
Ben Stokes is NASA products that haven't actually been released to the public, that are being sort of tried.
Only used by military and,
for intergalactic Stokes war down the track.
Stokes is Area 51 shit, isn't he? I mean, that's like, that's that's the reason people are going to storm Area 51, or they were a month ago, but they stopped doing that anymore. Okay, now someone else has been brought into the squad is Mitch Stark. I suspect he's going to play because he's been quite a big deal. He's been brought into the squad. Pattinson out. We're just purely talking Australian terms here before we get on to Anderson and Overton being brought in. But is everyone expecting Stark to play?
Mate, I reckon this is quite an interesting one, and it cuts to the heart of a lot of like elite cricket conversation and then public conversation, right? And I feel torn by it, right? Because I am a bit of a subscriber to the England momentum thing, and I think England, you know, the English players and England generally are quite good front runners. You know, we see when Australia goes well, they all say that they're going to lose, but as soon as they get ahead, they sort of they can put the foot down. The upside of Stark, as I see it, like strategically, is that in a scenario where England have just about made their way back into the series and Ben Stokes now looks impregnable, here is a guy that gives England a different problem to solve. It's a problem of pace. It's a problem of reverse swing, if it's as dry as they say that it is. And Stark has got the... you know, has had some success against Stokes, i.e. he's bowled some good balls to him. Also, he can dismiss the tail. So Stark, in many ways, is a bit of an antidote to the two things that Australia psychologically will struggle against after Headingley: Stokes and getting out the last fucking guy. So that part's
mutually
really
assured destruction.
But as a former international player said to me out the side of his mouth via text, that is, you know, mate, you know, he's no good if he's going to spray him around everywhere, is he? Now, I'm assuming that accent from what he wrote on WhatsApp.
Are you talking to Warney on WhatsApp?
No. This guy doesn't talk like that at all. But it was just, look, if he's spraying him around everywhere, why would you pick him? And, I guess that's a fair point too. And I sort of followed up and I said, like, can we kind of deduce that if they've not picked him, then he probably is spraying him around in the nets? And just, you know, I just got a yep. But it was a Y, just a Y. I didn't need to, they didn't need to write the other two letters.
I can see is we've done this with other players. Like, we deprived Josh Hazlewood of playing in the World Cup and the first test, and now he's bowling unbelievably well. Steve Smith's obviously killing it after being out for 12 months. So the strategy of depriving test-ready players through suspensions, deprivation theory and or like weird selection policy seems to be paying dividends in the longer term, albeit costing us in the short term. Like, fucking treat him mean, keep him keen is what I'm saying.
Yeah. We've played hard to get with Stark.
We have.
And how keen is he?
Let's find out.
Stark needs to be nurtured. You know, for all of Warne's ultra-aggressive, you know, assessments of Stark's body language, he is a guy who does need to be, like, he's not a guy you can get up. You know, it's sort of any given Sunday, you know, Friday Night Lights stuff. You know, you got to nurture some players. Remember the Titans is what I'm thinking of.
His arm around the shoulder.
Yeah, you get an arm around the shoulder.
Have one little one-on-ones with him, little walks around the oval, little laps.
Yeah, you got to get a lap, Stark. You want to come from? Yeah, I'll do a lap. I worry about the sweeping change nature of, like, Australia had every right to win the third test match by 100-plus runs, and, like, they couldn't get the last guy out and they couldn't get Stokes out, and we all remember the Yorker that Stark bowled to Stokes in the World Cup. Absolute peach. One of the best balls you'll ever see. But I worry too much about the sweeping change nature, which we've seen in the past.
Well, you hate change. You've always hated change.
I don't like change, Dave, and that's what this is about. But so I don't know. I think Siddle has been doing an awesome job. But, I mean, there is the thing as well. There's 3 days between Test Match 4 and 5, so there could be a rotation thing.
Well, is the great question, though, he goes, and, like, I'm really interested in which way they go, because you can guarantee that, like, if Stark's selected, about 45% of people go, oh, panic. Right, but like, what's also interesting is that, like, if Australia kind of in this super stubborn way commit to their existing philosophy, which is really just about dry lines and not conceding four balls, which is the antithesis of the way Stark bowls. You know, it's kind of like Siddle versus Stark is like the battle for the philosophy of the Australian side at the moment. So if you pick Siddle, who's in the squad now, it's kind of like, you know, we're just going to give you, we believe we're going to eventually beat you in the arm wrestle. And you know that Australians can be, you know, very pig-headed about that stuff. They can go, well, no, this is our plan. We're sticking with it. We know cricket better than you, and we're going to win with this plan. It's a, like, it is a really interesting.
So you think panic stations?
Yeah, well, because it is binary. Obviously, if they go with Siddle, it means they're being conservative. It means they're being sensible. They're staying with a sensible centre. And if they go with Stark, that's bringing in socialism or fascism or either side of the politics. And but maybe that's a kind of, you know, fundamental economic change we need.
That's what they're doing in Italy. All right, Dave, just before we get on, we're now taking just the 25 minutes to get to talking about England, and we'll give this 35 seconds. But James Anderson has been ruled out of the Ashes. Craig Overton's come into the squad to replace him for Manchester anyway. I mean, how significant do you think over the course of the season? Because I feel like if Anderson's playing, it would give them a bit of a selection headache for one, especially now that Moeen Ali's out of the squad as well. But, like, I mean, it's surely huge that Anderson has bowled four overs in this Ashes.
Yeah, I mean, he's out of the Ashes now, and we don't need to think about him anymore, which is great, because he was all we were thinking about in the lead-up to the Ashes. So big that's time. You know, one horrible situation removed, which is good for us. I mean, Craig Overton replacing him. Overton doesn't scare me. I mean, I'm sure he bowls good lines and length. I'm sure he's a lovely bloke. Doesn't scare me. Doesn't incite fear in me or other Australians, I presume. So, I mean, I don't know much about him. I'm sure he's going to do a good job. But I'm very, very thankful James Anderson isn't playing.
Who are you?
Who am I scared of?
Yeah.
In cricket?
Who scares you? Yeah, in cricket.
Generally.
Anything.
Generally. Anything. Oh, mate, where do I start? Every time I walk outside my house, the next door neighbour scares me. I walk across the road, bloke owns the cafe, hates me. Go to the bus stop, bus driver doesn't want to fucking accept me when I don't have enough money on my Opel card. It's tough. Life's tough.
Pez Bumrah took a hat-trick against the West Indies. Thoughts?
Well, firstly, it's great that I just on James Anderson. Oh, yeah. It's a shame that he won't be able to bowl from the James Anderson end.
That's
wanted to say
true.
That. Just wanted to see it, like novelty. It would have been fun for like 10 seconds and then annoying.
Mm. Like the slope.
But unlike Warne's gadding ball, just watch that shit forever. That's just sex. Yeah, well, Bumrah, you know. It's you know, you always feel it's like when you watch a band early. Not that like we saw, you know, what we saw from Bumrah last year was his early Doors stuff, but like in relation to maybe what some of our English friends have seen, there's a lot of English people sort of going, "Oh, is this guy any good?" And yeah, he's the best. And I thought someone else,
but on the band analogy, he's still playing the same hits. This isn't like his second album. It's the same fucking cool shit he came out with. Yeah, just playing him overseas
now.
Yeah.
I think it was Dave Tickner on Twitter, a very, very good follower on Twitter, very funny, who said in Bumrah and Archer, the two best fast bowlers in the world don't have run-ups. That's you know, really interesting if you like cricket, but I forgot, sorry for saying something Ernest said.
Number one test bowler in the world, though, Pat Cummins. But I tell you who was good at Lords against the slope, Glenn McGrath. Geez, he used it well. Just nip it up and down the hill. No dramas. All right, that's enough from us. Our Indian fans will be hugely satisfied with that 15 seconds of Jasprit Bumrah. It's kind of like when Voges got like 200 or whatever, and Sean Marsh, they batted for like 3 days against West Indies. Does it count? Not sure. That's me just denigrating international cricket as success. All right, we're going to speak to Doug Bolliger and Steve Waugh now, then hashtag RCGC.
Lads, we don't sort of do this very often these days, that is, call out the statistics, but let's just do this one for fun. I'm just going to say some numbers. 168 tests, 10,927 runs, a high score of 200, an average of 51.06, 32 hundreds, 50 50s, 92 wickets, a best of 5 for 28, 3 fifers, 356 first class matches, 24,052 runs, highest of 216 odd out, average of 51.94, 79 tons, 97 50s. He's an Australian cricketing demigod. He's the face of our dominance and our success, and most importantly, right now, our national collective sense of safety. He's been rushed into camp for Old Trafford, and because of that, it's our deep pleasure to introduce for the second time to the great cricketer, Stephen Roger Waugh. Tugger, hello.
Thanks, boys. Thanks for the introduction. You just forgot my catches.
How many catches do you recall?
Oh, I can't remember. 100 plus, mate. Give me your homework, boys. That's very good. Thanks for the introduction.
No, you're welcome. Steve, let's start earnestly, because there are a number of people listening to this cast who felt physically sick after the events of Headingley. They wrote to us, they texted us, they were looking for solace. We couldn't provide any because we were down to Tugger, you are the king of winning, the king of all things psychology. What's your message to the Australians out there ahead of Old Trafford? Can you rouse us?
I know, definitely. Look, the guys are in, they're in good space right now. Yeah, obviously, like all Australians, I watched that myself, and it was one of those incredible test matches. I'm wrong in the result, but at the end of the day, we probably dominated that test match all of the last 10 overs. So there's plenty of positives to take out of that. They put themselves in a position to win the match. Ben Stokes, individual brilliance. I mean, it was really one of the great test match innings. So sometimes you throw your hands up and say, it was just one of those days, much like in Calcutta in 2001, where Dravid and Laxman batted the whole day, and Laxman got 281. It was sometimes you'd walk away and say, well, they were better than us on the day. So that's the way test cricket goes, but it sets itself up for a fantastic two test matches to go, and we have the team to definitely win this series.
So just on the mood, sorry, hey guys, just on the mood, Tugger, I mean, yeah, you spent the first two tests with the squad before reuniting now. Has the mood changed between now and then? And secondly, how much secret pleasure have you taken by their complete capitulation in your absence?
I'll disregard the second part of that question, but
please do.
The first part, I think the mood's good. Training yesterday was an exceptional training, and I tend to judge training sessions on the way the guys feel. That to me is an attitude thing, and the fielding session yesterday was spot on. The guys, plenty of enthusiasm, energy, and quality in that session. So to me, the guys look in good shape. I've only been here 2 days. I haven't noticed any negative mood in the camp at all. In fact, they're excited about the challenge of the last two test matches and what's lying ahead, because it is a great opportunity for this side to really claim their own identity and to get the Ashes back for 18 years. So, this is what you play test cricket for, these moments. And the last two tests are going to be so exciting for the players. And, of course, all the Aussies who, when I got back home for 10 days, it made me realise how much this team is supported by the Australian public.
Well, you've obviously got some great personal memories, Steve, at Old Trafford. Obviously, you got 100 there in each innings in 1997. So I presume you've been sort of, talking the boys through each one of those runs, sort of pointing out, where to get your singles, short boundaries, how the wicket plays, that sort of thing.
I've got about 6 days to do that, mate, so that'll come over time. But it's actually funny because I walked out, so I hadn't been back to Manchester. I was briefly there for the semi-final of this year's World Cup, but it's the first time I walked out in the field, and it was like I was almost lost there because the ground has totally changed. In fact, the configuration of the pitch is totally the opposite way to the way it used to be. There are new stands there. The field just doesn't resemble what it did back 20 years ago. So for me, the change rooms in a different position, it's like being at a new ground. So those memories are sort of pretty foggy when you go on the ground because you can't really get your bearings.
Have you ever gotten, just an aside to that, have you ever gotten out in a match and then just walked the wrong way to the dressing room because you've been disorientated? I just always wonder that about
cricketers. No, I haven't done that, but I walked out to Lords, actually jumped out of the fence and walked out the wrong entrance the first time I played at Lords, because as a young kid I was playing to Somerset, never been to Lords before, and you walk down the stairs, the players' race, and you sort of turn right and go through the long room. And as I did that, I thought, why am I walking through here? There was like hundreds of members there all eating lunch, smoking cigars. I must be the wrong way. So I instead went straight ahead past the writing room, out the wrong door, and then realised there's no entrance to the field. So I actually hopped over the fence at Lord's. So I think I'm probably the only cricketer ever to do that. So I've gone out the wrong way, but I've always made my way back okay.
There's been a lot of conversation, a lot of fun conversation about the roles both you and Ricky Ponting have played, both through the World Cup and now the Ashes. And there's a lot of conversation about the role you're playing with Justin Langer. We might ask you about that a little bit later. I know you're aware of your value to the Australian squad, but as the cameras swing to you on the various balconies of England's pavilions, are you aware of the impact that your visible televised presence has on the nation and how we feel and our sense of safety? And do you just squint those eyes a little bit more knowing that at home at sort of 11 p.m, 1 a.m, it feels really good to see?
Yeah, mate, I was thinking of that. I should get some sort of sponsorship, shouldn't I? Like some sort of sunglass sponsorship or some sort of tattoo put on my face, because I didn't realise how much time I was going to spend on the TV, to tell you the truth. But they have got these cameras now, which are totally focused on the support staff, so you can't avoid the cameras. But I didn't expect it on TV as much. In fact, I get regular messages saying, get your melon off TV, we've seen it. So Yeah, I thought, would have thought the action would have been out in the field, but these days they always look for something a little bit different.
Oh, man, yeah. If there was an opportunity for a Steve Waugh cam at, like, difficult moments during the Ashes matches, I'd be clicking that, you know? And I just wonder, I know you can't really reveal this, but I wonder whether maybe the comms manager or Gav Dovey or something said, look, we need you back on the balcony, Tugger, at any point, just given what's happening in the match, like the nation needs it.
Oh, look, mate, I'm happy if it makes Australians feel more secure yeah, look, I think it's part of what my role here in the team is. It's sort of behind the scenes, you know, with the players. And just this morning, you know, we go for a walk every morning. Mitch Marsh has got this walking coffee club, and that's sort of where I guess I do most of my work is, you know, just casual conversations, picking up on the vibe of the group and maybe what the issues are underlying of the team. And maybe if they're concerned about something or they want to know a bit about, you know, the ground we're playing out or the opposition, I'll just pick my brain. So my role is sort of behind the scenes, and I see myself as, you know, trying to get the players more confident and relaxed, and that's, you know, in the one-on-one situation. It's not about making big speeches in the team room. That's, you know, the coach's job and the captain, and I just try and fit in behind those guys and try and give them some comfort and guidance as to, you know, that hopefully they're on the right track.
So, Tugger, you've likened Justin Langer to a great psychologist, a man who compliments his reserves of knowledge with the control of the mind and so on. Do you still stand by this statement after he admitted he wanted to cry his eyes out and or smash up his hotel room in Leeds following the loss?
Look, that's understandable, mate. I think the rest of Australia was feeling the same way. Look, he gets very emotional, Lang, and he rides every ball, and that's, as he said, it's like the players are like his own kids. I mean, he's like a father figure to a lot of these guys. You know, it's a lot of tough love as well. They respect him. He loves coaching Australians. Incredible respect for the baggy green. So, you know, he's going to show his emotions occasionally. That's what I think that's what Australian supporters want. They want someone who cares, and he certainly does that. And, you know, that last test match was obviously a bit of a pill to swallow because when you're so close to retaining the Ashes and it's taken away from you, then it's only natural to show some emotion. But he's great with the guys, and he has a real good sense of picking up the vibe in the players and knowing when to speak to someone and to give them confidence sometimes, other times to be a little bit, I guess, harsh and tell them some home truths. So, yeah, that's what it's about being a coach. You've got to adult conversations, and he's very good at those.
So I sense there's some sort of like weird pressure externally around Tim Payne, his captaincy, his place in the team. I mean, you captain Australia in tests 57 times. I mean, it's more than quadruple the number of times most test careers even last. I mean, can you put into words the job that you think Tim Payne's done from the perspective of the crisis in which the team and the whole sport in Australia found itself in and went from when he took over up until now?
I think he's done an exceptional job. I don't think any Australian captain's been thrown into that scenario where it was so volatile and everyone had an opinion and you really couldn't please everyone. I mean, you had to find a way to do it his way in conjunction with Justin Langer. I think they've done an incredible job to turn the team around. And, you know, I find it very unfair some of the criticism he copped after the last test match. You look back at that final couple of hours and we were really beaten by a guy that played, you know, the innings of a lifetime, probably the 10 best test innings of all time. I thought our bowlers did a pretty good job. We missed some half chances, and that happens under pressure. That's always been the case in cricket, and always will be. So for him to cop criticism for Australia to lose that, sure, the referral was probably not the right option, but I'd say what, under pressure out in the middle and you think it's your last opportunity, then, you know, it's very easy to watch from the sidelines to say that was the wrong decision. But out in the middle, there was a couple of guys involved in that decision. They thought it was the right one. And at the end of the day, I guess you've got to trust the umpires to make the right decisions also under pressure. And it didn't happen that way, unfortunately, at Headingley. But, I always say to teams that you've got to take luck out of the equation. The great teams take luck out of the equation and play good enough that they don't need luck to win.
All right, Steve. Well, we really appreciate what you've offered to us in an international perspective. I mean, we are called the Grade Cricketer Podcast, so we can't leave without one grade cricket-related question. Mm-hmm. It's just really a brand commitment that we have. I'm just going to ask you one just with a little bit of trepidation, but I'll power on courageously. Just last season, it was put to us that during a Sutherland versus North Sydney grade cricket fixture a few years ago where your very talented son Austin was playing. He and the North Sydney player seemed to enter into a bit of a running war. At one point, The North's player turned around on the boundary to see none other than your great self on the boundary, perhaps with some excellently and subtly chosen words, much to his horror. The part that seemed most funny about this to us was later in the match, when we're told a ball rocketed between his legs and to the boundary, and you calmly walked around the boundary set at North City number 2, audibly clapping and calling fielding to him, and everyone heard it. The question is, A, can you verify this, and B, you know, do you want to write a reply to that?
Oh, look, it sounds reasonably correct, mostly, except the first part. Yeah, and Austin did cop an absolute gobble from his player, and as a parent, you sort of get a little bit concerned about that. So, yeah, look, there was, the rest of the story seemed pretty correct. Yeah, there was a little bit of fun, I think, at the end of the day, and maybe the cricket learned a lesson, but, yeah, that was all part of watching great cricket. I must have been, I enjoyed myself on that day and got a few runs, but, yeah, in an answer, the probably answer is yes, that was true.
Lovely. A few cans on the hill to make a day of it?
No, that's... Just water, I think.
Just on the water. That's a very sufficient answer. I think that'll
satisfy. It was just a little bit of advice, really. Just a bit of advice. That's all it was.
That's what we call it, too. Advice. My face is about to explode. That's hilarious. Tugger, thank you so much for your time. Second time you've come on the show. I mean, I think anyone out there who is of high profile, if Steve Waugh can come on here twice, then you know, there's no excuses for anyone else. So thanks again for helping us feel safe, Steve, with Old Trafford and then the Oval after that. And hopefully your advice can, not of the sledging kind, but your advice can help get the Aussie boys over the line.
Yeah, that'll be fine. I'm really confident we can win this series.
Okay, lads, this is one of our most requested guests that we've managed to get on the line here. Let me give you some numbers. 411 first-class wickets, swing and angle to die for, 12 tests and 50 wickets there too. Crick Info says he's a left-arm fast bowler more suited to cold beer than high-quality champagne. Let's find out if that's true. It's Doug Bollinger. Doug, welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast.
G'day, guys. I'd like to thank all the voters and that out there. I never thought I'd ever win an Emmy. That's a great intro. My gosh.
Doug, I want to kick off. We'll sort of kick off the same way, mate. And we should say, for listeners out there, like, you prefaced off air just before saying you're not on social media at all, which is great, because this could go anywhere. Yeah. But we kick off the same way. I read... Well, it says, according to Crick Info again, it says, you took Bollinger until his mid-20s to develop into one of the country's best bowlers after being happy running around in Sydney Park cricket. Can you tell us first about what park cricket means to you and then about what grade cricket means to you?
Yeah, absolutely, fellas. you weren't this serious off air. That's the funny thing. where did I start? I started... Well, what can I say? I grew up in Seven Hills in God's country on the west of Sydney. I played a bit of football, rugby league when I started for Toongabie Tigers. And then, believe it or not, Paul Gallen smashed me one day and I thought, no, that's enough of this. So I just basically gave cricket a go when I was 15 at Seven Hills Toongabie RSL. And, you know, four years of that. And then I got told to go and play great cricket for Fairfield. And then... You know, three games of third grade, two games of twos, first grade, then a rookie contract. It kind of spiraled out of control, which was fantastic.
It's just all so easy for you blokes, isn't it?
Yeah, it just rolls off the tongue. I'm tired of the couple of schooners. Shit, it's here, how good it gets.
Can you just recall... So you said I got told to play grade cricket.
Yeah. Just the guys I was playing with. Just the guys I was playing for 7 years with. You know, it was... two-piece ball on AstroTurf wickets, so it was a lot of fun. But you know, the guys just said, you know, go and try it. You know, just, you know, as I tell kids these days, your club will always be there, your mates will always be there. If you think you got, you know, up to 1%, you think you can have a crack, just go and do it. And that's basically what they told me to do. And here we are today, 38-year-old, 115 kilos.
Doug, you if I'm right, you didn't actually play cricket until the age of 15, and you certainly didn't play any junior rep cricket. I mean, these are the typical pathways to the Australian side. I mean, I still wear my junior rep shorts around the house, and I'm a 33-year-old father with a mortgage. But in terms of...
What shorts are they? What club is that?
You know, Emerging Blues 1999, you know, something that resonates with, I'm sure, of all our audience. I was a player, I promise. But, you know, you weren't in the system, is what I'm saying.
To bring the promise.
Just a player. But, yeah, mate, you came to the game very late, obviously, and you had raw natural ability.
Yeah, mate, I was. And, you know, I know there's all programs and all that out there now, which can help kids and all that, and, you know, young men coming through. But I'm actually glad I missed all that. I got to, you know, establish my own way and my own time and at my own pace, and I think that can be very beneficial for a lot of young players out there. So, but, you know, everything's changing, everything's evolving, and, you know, maybe that's just the old school way. Like, we, you know, even you kind of guys led that way, I guess, with all the guys you played with.
I was just thinking, just like, but when you were playing, sort of peaking your career, when you're playing your test match cricket, you were sort of buying 140, 145. Now, obviously, you know, that you probably got fitter as you got older and stuff, and you got more professional in your cricket. But, like, I'm thinking about facing you on, like, AstroTurf with a two-piece ball.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Sean Tate and, like, parents asking Sean to, like, bowl slower and stuff so they wouldn't hurt their children. Yeah. Like, how quick were you when you're bowling, you know, on AstroTurf with a bloody two-piece ball? That is frightening.
Mate, it's hard to tell, you know, how fast you're bowling when the curfew is 2 a.m. for club cricket. but no, I don't know. It's just different because, you know, it's a two-piece ball that swings a lot more, and you probably don't have as much control, mate. And, you know, I was what, you know, between 18 and 20 years old when I was doing that. So, mate, I had no idea what I was doing. I was just happy having a run around with my mates and just enjoying the game, you know, and I think that's just the best way to be.
And so it's like you end up, you know, ascending to grade cricket to Fairfield. You're very quickly in the first grade side. Like, what are your memories of just the culture of that side and grade cricket, you know, both on the field and off?
Yeah. Mate, I love grade cricket. I thought grade cricket was fun, you know. I never thought of it, you know, when you're starting up, when you're growing up, you know, you never thought you'd be, you know, playing at, you know, Caringborough Oval or Rosedale Oval, where only four guys have got a six straight there, kind of thing, you know. You never think you're going to, you know, play with these guys before and against these guys that, you know, that have played or played first-class cricket. It's a massive shock to the system, but it's a good growing, you know, it's a good growing up curve as well.
What did you, like, as someone who just kind of burst on the scene late and just were clearly destroying everyone in your path, and I actually remember that, we're all playing Sydney grade cricket at the same time and basically everybody was afraid of you. Like, what did you make of the guys who... North Sydney primarily, Doug, and Balmain. We'll come to that in a second, because there's a story there. But, like, what did you make of the guys who were, you know, walking around in the proverbial rep shorts, you know, who'd been doing it since they were kind of 11 years old and were, like, earmarked to go and play? Like, were they a bit worried about you just coming in out of nowhere?
No, mate. To be honest, I didn't really take any notice of it because, you know, I was very, you know, I'd never experienced it before, so I was very green. I was very, you know, just go out there and bowl and play the game, you know. I never really took much notice of it. And to be honest, I didn't really know anything about it, you know. I just got to grow up and play the game where you do well and you get picked. You know, I think that's the easiest way of explaining it. And, you know, and I just had fun. But, yeah, it was good to meet those younger guys, but it probably gave you more of an opportunity to beat them, you know. You know, they've got these batters or bowlers, or probably not bowlers, so they don't bat very much, but, you know, you're bowling against these batters that are in these teams, so, you know, they make them competition, I guess.
Doug, so yes, you played for New South Wales after a single season of grade cricket. And I think you actually, when you made it to New South Wales, and we had him on the podcast earlier, Steve Waugh, it was your first captain playing for New South Wales. What was it like coming into the side, you know, as a raw youngster and the great Steve Waugh is there as your skipper?
Yeah, mate, it's so unreal. It's so similar. I mean, well, they're the same words, really. They mean the same thing anyway. but, you know, it was so good. Like, I'll just go, it was so good. was so much fun, eh? Like, I just think, you know, besides Stephen, we had Stephen and Mark, Michael Slater, Stuart McGill, Stuart Clark, Michael Bevan, Brad Haddon. You know, all these guys are in your team. You're thinking, holy crap, like, I was watching these blokes 6 months ago in the summer just leading into this, you know. These guys are so respected and, you know, legends of the game, and here I am playing with them. And, mate, I just took it all in, you know. I'm a big question asker. I like to learn a lot. I like to ask questions. And I think, you know, I just really enjoyed my time with them.
Did you, when you walked into, like, the change room, were people in set positions in there? And where did you kind of slip into in terms of a corner position, or where'd you kind of find your place?
I think you just find your way around, you know. You kind of just suss out where everyone goes and where everyone sits, and then you kind of find your own seat. And I think that's wonderful where you can find your own seat. And I found mine. I found mine after Brett Lee in the SCG room. Which was a great seat to be in. But, yeah, I reckon that's really good that you take your time, you soak everything in and think, right, that's my seat, you know. And I reckon that's really mad.
When you debuted for Australia, Doug, obviously it was an SCG home test debut. I believe you were quoted as saying that you would give 150,000%. First of all, is that the most you've ever given anything? But also, like, was that just a completely surreal experience? Or, I mean, talk us through, like, how you sort of found out about it.
I remember that. A few people have let that down, but that's the fun of it, mate. I was just saying what I felt, you know. I'm about to play test cricket at the number, you know, I reckon one or two best cricket grounds in the world, and, you know, you're excited, you don't know what to say, you're speechless, you say silly stuff, but that's just how I felt, mate. You know? People can laugh at it, that's fair enough, but that's just how I felt at the time, and still feel at that time when you're going to play in the country.
Do you reckon you would have had less injuries if you'd played at less than 150,000%? Just slightly.
Oh, God.
So, Doug, let's go to your test career now. You took 50 wickets, an average of 25 in 12 tests, which is an absolute nightmare for OCD sufferers, but, you know, a wonderful return. Your first test match was against South Africa, wasn't it, in the SCG, the famous match. Can you run us through the debut?
Oh, wow. You find out you're playing, you warm up, obviously you're excited, and you know, you see the crowd pouring in, and Ricky Ponting gives you a hat and, you know, says, you know, a wonderful speech, and you put it on and you warm up with it, and you're just soaking up the atmosphere. You're just thinking, oh my God, I'm can't believe I'm about to play a test match. And then there it is, you know, the 5 days go so quick, you know. I think that's the test match Graham Smith got his hand broken, I think, and they won late. I think that's the game, but no, mate, it was good. I think I got, did I get Graham McKenzie or Mono Malcolm? Graham McKenzie or Mono Malcolm? That was my first test wicket, but it's just an amazing experience, and I really enjoyed the time, and, you know, it's just one of those things I can't take away.
This test was actually well known for the dressing room spat between Kadich and Clark. Can you put the issue to rest? Was this over the fact that Pup didn't want to sing that weird second verse that no one really knows?
To be honest, I have no idea, mate. I don't know, everyone's brought up, but I have no idea. I've probably had a couple of beers by then, just, you know, taking in the party and the atmosphere after the test match, you know. It just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that happens, and yeah, I think everyone should just put it to rest.
So you played in a test that was probably one of Australia's greatest ever comebacks, certainly in recent time. That was against Pakistan at the SCG in January 2010. For those playing at home, it was Australia bowled out for 127 on the morning of day one, and then third innings, Mike Hussey hit 138, massive partnership with Pete Siddall, and they set you guys set Pakistan a total of 175 in the fourth innings, and then you bowled them out for 139 in a pretty famous comeback for Australia. I mean, how do you reflect on that game now, and just sort of what happened to Headingley, sort of bring back any sort of similar memories, sort of come from behind victories?
No, mate, I think that we just played well, you know. We just knew we were in a rut, and from what I can remember, I think we all just chipped in with a few wickets. We caught well and we fielded well, and it's one of those games that can happen in the game of cricket, you know. You guys have played it pretty a bit, and the game can turn very, very quickly. So they're always exciting, those games. And what do you say, the next one, the one at Headingley? Isn't that amazing how that you know, the game started so on top for Australia, and it just to just one little innings or one, you know, one innings of 100. But, Ben Stokes batted well. I think you guys probably watched ball for ball, didn't you? And and saw it. But, you know, I did as well, you know. I can't say I didn't watch much of the World Cup, but I haven't missed much of the Ashes. It's just because it's such an awesome series to watch. And I reckon England's one of the harder places to play cricket, mate.
Mm-hmm. Just on that, Doug, I mean, are you still, now that you've retired, I mean, there's a lot of guys who prefer to play than watch, you know, like, are you one of those guys, or do you like tuning in? Do you stay in touch with the guys, and what are you making of the series? You know, do you think the Aussies can come back?
Yeah, absolutely. I still speak to quite a few of the guys a lot, actually, and I think it's good to keep in touch, you know. I think they're the things, you know, the game will always be there, but, you know, the memories and the friendships you make, I miss that the most, you know. And I try and play golf with the guys whenever I can, and it's good to be around the guys. I try and catch up with them, but, you know, everyone's got their own lives, and as we know now, cricket's a 12-month series now. So I remember it used to be finishing one day in December, and then you wouldn't come back till start of February. So me and my now wife would go up to Early Beach for 6 weeks.
Glorious.
Yeah, Doug, do it.
Did you even say glorious?
Yeah, glorious. Early Beach, yeah,
that's
lovely.
That's a good word. That's a dynamite word. I reckon the Aussies come back absolutely, mate. I reckon they've played so well. I'm trying to be serious now, but I can hear you laughing. But they're playing, mate, they're playing so well now. They've got a good crop. I just saw today, I feel for Usman Khawaja getting dropped, but, you know, I think Stephen Smith, he's a pretty good player as well. And, you know, Stuart Starkey must be bowling well, because I don't think James Pattinson's done, you know, too much wrong in the couple of tests he's played. He's bowled fast, he's been aggressive, he's got in the game, and, you know, and they're just the situations you're forced with some now. So, I'd love to see Australia win this test.
Doug, it's a total privilege for us to be able to speak with you, a guy with an excellent career, and a very admirable career, a very, very quick bowler, and obviously one of the more colourful guys that has been extremely highly requested on this show. So we appreciate you coming
how
on, mate.
How highly requested?
Yeah, truly, and thanks for your reflections.
That's cool. No, that's good, guys. Thanks for having me, and, you know, if I can help you later on, you know, in the future, give me a buzz. It's great to talk to you, and any of you guys can share cricket-wise, I'd love to help you out.
Doug Bollinger, what a legend. Well, listeners to this podcast have probably seen our promotion of this week's show, where you will see none other than the polarising Nathan Lyon at Australian cricket training yesterday, as we go to where, in his nice Gary budgies. Which many people texted us about and were excited by, and so are we. And it just goes to show that budgie smugglers are ubiquitous among, well, the fashion elite, like Nathan Lyon, as well as the sporting elite like Ben Stokes. One thing that's worth mentioning about budgie smugglers is they keep you locked in. Now, when I say that to you, Dave, and he goes, when I say locked in, what do you think of?
I'm thinking a locked in feel. I feel like a locked-in mortgage, locked-in contracts. Yeah, no lock-in contracts.
I get concerned about being locked inside. I mean, maybe the doors are locked and I can't get out, and that causes me to fear.
You know those like escape rooms that are in the city, and you go like in a group of people that you work with, and you kind of go to like, you're like, it's like a solving thing. It's like a team bonding experience, but they kind of suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Solving thing.
It's a solving thing.
Yeah.
Or locked-in syndrome. For example,
which is what I feel I have whenever I talk to you guys and the internet goes down. You can't hear me.
Exactly. But one good, I guess, locked in phenomenon is the locked in of your peace, of your bits, and that's something that budgie smugglers do, and that's probably why Nathan Lyon was wearing them at training on the outside of his jockstrap, and. This is something that we'd like to amplify.
It is funny how like Budgie are just part of the Ashes story now. Like people are sending us screenshots of stump cam of Ben Stokes's behind, you know, the Nathan Lyon stuff, the nice Gary's, you know, we're selling the Alpha Range. I thought that sold out, didn't it? So, you know, it is funny how like that, like somehow Budgie have weaseled their way into the story of the Ashes, and I am here for it.
Yeah. I don't think you should talk about our sponsor, you know, with the word weaseled involved, but we won't edit that out because we're professional.
Well, I mean, Budgie Smuggler does target blokes with ordinary rigs. Yep. If they didn't, I wouldn't be talking about this.
Well, blokes with ordinary rigs have high levels of disposable income.
BudgieSmuggler.com.au.
Just before we get into hashtag ICGC, just a chance to plug the we've actually dipped our toes into the merch waters, as some many fans out there have seen. We've made 4 stubby holders are available. There's actually no link on our website at the moment, but if you go to BatutaOutfitters.com, you'll find the Grey Cricketer merchandise there, which is 4 different stubby holders with different graphics on them. I encourage you to check it out at BatutaOutfitters.com. We obviously thank the Batuta Advocate for their help setting us that stuff up, as well as, you know, this podcast. So there's that. And Pez, we also had to mention, pre-season events are just starting to kick off. Season openers are starting to kick off. You know, keep us in mind.
A lot of people are in pre-season at the moment. There's a lot of social committees getting together. There's a lot of groups getting together talking about culture with whiteboards and stuff,
yep,
and definitions.
Goal setting.
It's actually one of the hardest words to define in sociological terms. But if your club is, you know, keen to have some sort of kick-off social function to start the year, then, you know, consider the Grey Cricketer with, you know, content delivered and created and informed by things that happened after 1970. You can get in touch with us at greycricketer@gmail.com or on any of our social channels, really. And we'll go from there.
Or the website, greycricketer.club. That's what it's there for.
That's a good idea.
All right. Hashtag ICGC. Here we go. That's 4 of the best. We're going to kick off with Tim Chandler. He says, I was at Twickenham for England versus Wales recently. The seats I had were in a good location to the left of the tunnel. To my surprise, before the national anthems were sung, I spied Rare Unit Bairstow walk up the steps 2 seats away from me. Will cricket never leave me alone, he says. The crowd in the local vicinity offered a polite applause, and as he walked past, whilst I, a passionate English supporter, offered a thanks for winning the World Cup, Johnny. More on this to come. In response to this, he promptly ignored me and walked straight past, leaving me on the physical embodiment of red. When his face was projected on the big screen later during the match, my brother, who was also at the game in the cheap seats, yelled at the screen, score some fucking runs. This is pre-Lord's 50 at the projected Bairstow. My question is this, what the fuck is wrong with me? Why the fuck did I offer a polite thank you to a bloke who's a bad test away from being bowled by a wind ball on an AstroTurf in the most village setting imaginable? Am I so beta I fall into the realm of gamma? How do I deal with rejection? Is my brother alpha for abusing an international cricketer without any regard for any sort of consequences? Or is my brother beta for advising a proven international test batsman on how to bat? He is beta. He said it's for a cheap laugh. Is Bairstow alpha for maintaining all composure in a 90,000-seater capacity stadium? Or is he beta for ignoring fans and well-wished thank yous, thoughts and prayers? P.S. Daniel Craig was also at the game, would make a good addition to the Alpha Smugglers.
He goes, are you saying beta?
Yeah.
Like, I know, I think some people have provided feedback that that's how you meant to say it.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right. I had to force right. The beta, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's your takeaway from the question.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Because it reads as beta, obviously, or better, I suppose. Better electrical. one for the UK fans there. Sorry, just having a word association game with myself. it's an inside joke.
It's a real inside joke.
You said it really quickly so as to beat us to apparently saying it.
Yep.
Thanks for winning the World Cup, Johnny. So that's what he said. Yep. And he's brushed. Well, no fucking wonder he's brushed you. Like, you're 2 metres away from Johnny Bairstow and you've got one shot to make an impression. And that
shoot your shot, man.
Fucking gut-wrenchingly sycophantic, that is. Sad.
But I understand how Tim feels, because, like, we've just spent, you know, the evening talking to, I presume, all of our heroes at one point, Doug Bollinger, Steve Waugh, and, like, it's nerve-wracking. You know, we've obviously been very fortunate enough to speak to some very successful and, you know, high-profile cricketers, and, like, these people are legitimately heroes, and it's nerve-wracking to, like, you know,
I was trembling just talking to Steve Orr over a Skype connection. Like, exactly. I can't imagine how I would feel if I actually was face to face with him.
Johnny World Cup is what they call him, but Johnny Bairstow he's just won the World Cup for them, and you know, this is two weeks after the event, sees him, spots him, just says a nice thing. You know, maybe Johnny didn't hear it. I don't know. This is actually a relatively normal Bairstow story, which I've received, which was, you know, I could actually read out because it's not, you know, libelous or whatever. So, yeah.
Well, can I just clear one thing up?
Clear
the
up, mate.
Brother who yells at a screen, score some fucking runs, is nothing close to Alpha. No. I don't know how in any realm or world that's Alpha yelling at a screen when the guy's like a couple hundred metres away from you. So let's just rule that out. It could be very possible that you and your brother are beta or better electrical team. It could be possible.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. This one is from someone called Anonymous, who's writing a lot of submissions lately. Hi, lads. I'm a park cricketer who very much bats in the tail. Recently, I chucked a sickie from work to spend a day knocking in my new bat ahead of the summer season, as the missus said it was too loud in an apartment block during the evening. Do I need to reevaluate my priorities in life?
I was kind of wondering, like, why he made himself anonymous, if it's like his boss must also listen to the show, or if, you know, his significant other, his missus might also listen. So, you know, he didn't want to shame himself in front of her, but it's probably the boss thing, right? So, I mean, that I've just answered a question to myself, which didn't exist. Do I need to reevaluate my priorities in life? I'm kind of surprised that people are still knocking in bats. Like, aren't they pre-knocked in, most of them, these days?
Yeah.
I was afraid to ask that as well, lest giveaway, they've not played the code for a couple of years.
Yeah.
In any
it's definitely not cool
endeavor,
to
that, like,
knock in a bat publicly.
No.
You don't want to be able to answer this question, because if you play enough grade cricket, you sort of end up getting on, like, the, you know, the bat, you know, black market. You know, people are just handing bats over there. Oh, this is Mossy's, you know, this is his old one. So he doesn't want
Mossy.
So you never actually know. You just presume that they're all.
Don't know who Mossy is, but.
Sam,
are
you talking,
like,
about, you're talking about John Moss, the Victorian representative cricketer that you played with?
Well, Ian Moss, the cold chisel guitarist. I don't know how old this bloke is, or whether his workplace is actually missing him not being. Like, he might be a C-suite executive who's, you know, cleared his outlook to knock in a bat. But I suspect not. I assume he has a job that he's not emotionally financially invested in.
Yeah, hospitality.
I think these days you can work from home. Like, flexible workplaces are very modern phenomena. So if you had to knock in your bat, you could work from home and knock your bat in, say, every hour for 10 minutes. Again, I don't know what his job is. You know, if he works on a construction site or in a call center, this wouldn't be feasible, of course.
Yeah.
I guess so you're saying he wouldn't need to reevaluate his priorities in life if his company
had a flexible workplace arrangement.
Yeah. If it's like a WeWork situation.
Hot desking.
Hot desking.
Well, WeWork, you would do it at a WeWork office. You have to pay through the nose for that stuff as well, and then you'd be knocking in a bat at your station.
And everyone around you is building an app that's insufferable.
Isn't this, like, part of the thing of just, like, what did our parents have to go through to, like, you know, make us, you know, play cricket till, you know, till we're 30? I'm just like, do you remember, like, you had to knock in your bat and you're, like, 12 and you just love the thing so much. You just wanted to be prepared. You're knocking in the edges, the corners, the splice, you know, just trying to find the sweet middle. And then nothing felt better than, like, you hit the middle with, like, with the mallet and, like, it barely felt like that thing was hitting the wood, you know? Just so, like, you're literally knocking in a house in a suburban environment. You know, your sister is in year 9. You know, she's got her own things going on. Your dad's just come from home for work, just wants to come out and have a quiet drink. You know, the dog's barking. Just absolute chaos. And then comes the weekend, then you got to drive like 3 hours to play a game of cricket where you get a duck and drop 4 catches.
But he goes, back then, everyone lived on a quarter acre block. And there wasn't the kind of issues around sound that exist today. You know, we live in paper thin wall apartments that have been built on the cheap. You know, cladding, all these issues, these modern problems all kind of come together in this question that Spike has asked. I don't know if we answered it, but we gave it a shot.
Stick with it if we can, it's still got some life. Like, can somebody explain to me the mechanics, like the architecture, the science behind a bat needing to be knocked in? Like, is it because we all pretend we know about wood and bats and stuff like that, but like, is it, like, what other thing do you need to to bash manually for like 4 to 6 hours before it starts working beyond what you've got.
That's going to solicit some interesting responses.
Like, what's the idea? Is it about like compressing the wood? And if so, like, wouldn't you just, shouldn't there be a machine?
That should be automated. You're right, Pez. There is a machine.
There is a machine, yeah.
Yeah, but okay, can you just explain to me, just be, like, you're just making these solitary bashes, like solitary, like small, minimal bashes into wood, and surely they're creating just little dents in and of themselves that then create a little ridge with the next element of the wood, and then you've got to find that ridge and flatten it out.
Yeah.
What is the science behind it? Can someone give me the basic principle of knocking in a bat, like what the meaning
It feels as well like a bit like how you buy a pair of jeans. You've got to break in the pair of jeans before they're comfortable. I mean, it's obviously the same thing, and also the same machine which does both of those things, i.e. a mannequin. But like, you also can't use a new ball with a new bat. You have to use an old ball. So why?
It's like the ultimate offer? Like example of edging in cricket. Like, you've just got to wait so long, it's so frustrating, and then finally you get to use it, and it's just such a tantric build-up. It takes so long knocking in a bat, and we can't wait. We're a time-poor society. We want everything right now, and it's very difficult in 2019.
Sting was excellent with cricket bats. Really, really took his time.
12-hour sessions, insatiable.
Consider myself educated. Julie Rogers writes in, "Hi there, I one of your very few XX chromosome listeners, but want to say that the podcast have me laughing out loud, usually on the bus to and from work, so I do get strange looks, but frankly, I don't give a shit. Higo's laugh is exceptional too. Anyway, my question is it acceptable now for my 16-year-old paying or playing with the seniors to wear a pair of the now famous budgie smugglers in the showers, or is it just a rite of passage for him to get naked and get on with it? Thanks, TBC. Keep laughing, Higo."
Get naked and get on with it.
Get on with it. 16, get on with it. Too. Get on with it.
Your mum saying that too? Listen, are you tubbing, son, in the showers? Not sure, Mum. I might wear my budgies. Listen, get naked and get on with it.
Get on with it. Get on with it.
Just get on with it, mate.
Oh, this is so good. Like, I wish our podcast was around for my mum to listen to when I was growing up. Like, these insights.
You wish you could podcast to your mum.
Oh, just these insights are invaluable. Like, kids these days have got no idea how good they've got it. Like, the internet has provided them with just a fountain of knowledge. Like, back in our day, you had to buy Britannica, or, you know, Microsoft Encarta did a job. But these days, podcasts are just dishing out valuable life lessons for free.
See, I reckon he's 16, to answer Julie's question. At 16, he should most definitely be wearing smugglers. And, you know, maybe smugglers have made it into the lexicon of cricketers out there, where it's, like, acceptable to be wearing that. You can wear them on the field. You know, heroes are wearing them during the games. He's a 16-year-old kid. You know, he's just finding himself. You know, he's been comfortable with his body. If he's showering, if he's going into the showers with grown men, I say fair play to that young man. You know, and, you know, give it a couple of years and he'll be tubbing with the best of them. You know, four-hour sessions with a couple of, you know, beverages of his choice. Always drink responsibly. But until then, get the budgies on. Have a tub, you know, learn about yourself, learn about, you know, strange men's behavioural, you know.
Get naked and get on with it. And just remember that Medicare provides 6 complimentary consultations for mental health later down the track when you might need that.
I agree with you, Higos, and Dave, especially on the 6 sessions covered by Medicare. But I just want to temper it a little bit and say, like, because we've learnt from a lot of the players who've come on this show, and they're around sort of 25, 26, true, most of them international cricketers, they're saying that they hated getting the showers as kids, but now they're the kind of hunters, whereas previously they were the hunted. Mm-hmm. So I think this 16-year-old is getting to the showers, and he's still got 25-year-olds who are telling him he's got to get nude, because that's what they were told from the previous generation. It's going to take one more generation to maybe just temper the shower culture a little bit. You know, perhaps his 16-year-old could be part of the leadership movement to stop the pressure on needing to get nude, particularly when you're underage and it's probably illegal and just a little bit sadistic to be making a child to do that.
All we need is a hashtag. We need a hashtag to get behind, and then that'll really set the trend going.
Yeah, that's how you do anything these days.
Joe Dawson says, "Hi, fellas. I am currently a student in Year 12 who is sitting their ATAR, and I have my exams in quite a short period of time. My mock exams are in around 3 weeks, whilst my ATAR exams start in October, November. I had been looking forward to the year of 2019 for a long time, as I knew that both the Cricket World Cup and the Ashes in England were on, as well as all the festivities that come along with being in my final year of high school. I made an effort to attempt to watch nearly every single hour of cricket that has been on TV for the past however many months. To be honest, I have lost track because I'm so sleep deprived. This is not only affecting my academic results and sporting successes, but also my personal and spiritual well-being and relationships. I've developed a caffeine addiction at the age of 17 due to the cricket, and find myself watching the 2005 Ashes documentary on YouTube whenever I'm meant to be studying to get me in the mood for the cricket that night. A personal low came 1 week ago when I thought I would wing an application test, the lowest ATAR math, with around 3 hours sleep. I went to bed at 2 and woke up at 5 because I also happened to participate in the event of rowing. My teacher is a bit of a legend. This is why his frown of disapproval hurt when my emotional well-being when he handed back my test with a score of 25%. My final few months before I hit adulthood have consisted of falling asleep on my desk, being impersonal whilst around the presence of other human beings, and have extreme sleep deprivation. Not to mention such events such as England tying the World Cup, questioning why I'm persisting at life if someone as nice as New Zealand can have something they were so deserving of taken away from them. So my question is, do I let cricket get in the way in what was before this year a seemingly bright and successful future? Should I let my emotional dependence on the fickle sport of cricket get in the way of my ATAR exams, personal relationships and healthy lifestyle? And should I draw a line in the very near future before my life goes off the rails and I'm a 35-year-old man with an alcohol addiction who brags about how much potential he had at school only to work in the public sector as a PR advisor?"
Oh, man. This
thanks, Joe.
This good young question. Bloke seems to have a great level of self-awareness and is clearly writing to us for his own personal amusement, as evidenced by, you know,
could have been studying during the whole
quips
time.
Quips around, the meaning of life and, the alcoholic private sector worker. So I've got no doubt that he'll be successful in life regardless of his ATAR results. So, mate, keep staying up and watching cricket. Drink your coffee. Do all the stuff that makes you happy because life is short and you're young and you're probably quite employable. So good luck to you.
Yeah, I was really enjoying the question to that final line. Hit extremely close to home. But, alarmingly close to home. But, I mean, I guess the other flip side of this is that, also, if you're a cricketer, Joe, and it appears as though you are, what you're doing is a long game excuse, like a long game setup for why you got a low ATAR, right? And I say that as someone who has some experience of that. But, you know, if it's just about what you want, you know, if you want a higher ATAR, then you've got to make those sacrifices. But if you want to make an excuse and just say that I watched the cricket the whole time and for that to work quite well, then keep doing what you're doing. Also, I'm your dad.
That's weird.
How dryly you said that. Joe, your ATAR score will not define you as a person. It's very hard when you're in year 12 and like all your friends are talking about and there's familial pressure and all that stuff. It's a cocoon that you get trapped in. It won't define you and people will forget about it in a year or two's time. But what people won't forget about is the 2005 Ashes series. You know, it could be worse as well. You could be a 33-year-old man who, podcasts about cricket endlessly with said alcoholic consumption. All right. If there's no other business, I'll wrap it up here. Wrap it up here, lads. Thank you so much for Doug Bollinger for joining the show, for Steve Waugh for joining the show. Old Trafford is in – it's tomorrow, isn't it? What's going to happen? We'll be back immediately after the end of the fourth test match over there in Manchester. So we'll see you then. Ian Higgins here signing off with Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. We'll see you next time.